I'm David Zellner.
And I'm Nathan Zellner.
We are the filmmakers of Kimiko the Treasure Hunter, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to episode number 316 of Filmwax Radio. Thank you for listening. What a great episode we have. I should start with a little bit of an apology because I said on this episode I was going to have on Michael Schultz, the filmmaker, and, you know, I intended to, but other things kind of end up getting, you know, shifted about, and the next thing you know is I have extended myself due to deadlines, films having their premieres and theatrical screenings, et cetera, et cetera. So I've got to push the Michael Schultz back one more episode, but it's on the horizon. It's actually not even that far out. It's very close by, so that'll be on episode number 317. That's the plan. Anyway, maybe I should stop altogether announcing what the next show is going to be. I'm not sure. But anyway, thank you for listening to this episode. It's a good one. You have the filmmaker Guy Madden from Winnipeg, Canada. He's on this episode. And I've got lots to say about that. And then the other segment is going to be two co-directors that I wanted on the show for as far back as I've been doing it. So we have Annie Sundberg and Ricky Stern. They've made a bunch of films. They have, including, oh my, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, The Devil Came on Horseback. What was the most recent? Knuckleball. And now they have a new film. It's called In My Father's House, and it's coming out this Friday. And we're going to go to them in a minute to talk about that new documentary, which I just watched and was really moved by, I have to say. I always look forward to seeing their films. And I want to mention also that I once did a screening up at the Maisel's Cinema up in Harlem of their film, The Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, which is a great documentary. If you haven't seen it, you should do so. I think it's available on some of the more popular streaming sites. Ricky came and she came to the screening and we did the Q&A together along with one of, I think, her producers and the person who did the music for the film. So it was a really fun event and we had a nice turnout. I just remember that very fondly. So I'm looking forward to doing this segment with these wonderfully talented filmmakers. And that's coming right again. That film is called In My Father's House, which I'll talk about also in just a moment. But then there's Guy Madden, who I never met before. I've seen several of his films before. What have I seen? I've seen My Winnipeg and Brand on the Brain, I think was one. Though he's also known for a very well-known film called The Saddest Music in the World. These are very much hybrid types films. They're very self-reflective memoir-like in some cases, but they're also almost like dreamlike in others. The new film is no exception. It's called The Forbidden Room, and it is maybe his most ambitious project to date. It's being described as a phantasmagoric opus, pretty lofty. So and he's co-directed, I should also mention. This is another co-direction project. Evan Johnson, who I think was a former maybe student of his, but just proved to be an invaluable asset to Madden, and now they're collaborating. So he'll have something to say about that in the conversation. The film, again, it's called The Forbidden Room. It has had this incredible festival run so far. It premiered at the 2015 Sundance Film Festival, went on to the Berlin International Film Festival, then to Toronto just a few weeks ago. And now, just this past week, it was at the New York Film Festival and at the Woodstock Film Festival, where I actually ended up meeting up with Guy and hanging out together with him. And what fun he is. And this conversation was going to be, you know, the second of the two segments today. It was done over Skype because he has a teaching gig at Harvard for the year. And I wasn't sure if I was going to get time with him at Woodstock because, you know, I just didn't know. And so I didn't push it. So we got it out of the way beforehand. And then we met in person at Woodstock just this past weekend. And it was funny because I was in the opening night. No, it wasn't opening night. It was the second night. It was the filmmaker party. It was this past Friday evening. And I was there hanging out with some friends, and I look across the bar in this restaurant, which was actually in Kingston, New York. And across the bar, I see Guy Madden. You know, he's sitting there and he's in conversation and he's just, I see it, I recognize him. And so I hastily crossed the room over to where he was sitting and I apologize for interrupting his conversation. And who is he talking to but fellow Canadian Adam Egoyan, who, for listeners of this podcast, know Adam was just on the last episode. So this was a wonderful experience for me because, you know, I just reduced to being a fan of these two guys, you know. But they're both, first of all, funny. They both have great senses of humor. They're kind of different. I would say Adam is a little more low-key and drier, perhaps. Although Guy has a pretty dry sense of humor. He's a little bit more gregarious by nature. But they're both very Canadian in the sense that they're very polite, they're very generous, and very funny. And I find those to be common traits of Canadians. And I can sort of say that with some expertise because I have several really close friends up in Toronto and have for many years. So anyway, all right, well, listen, let's review. Segment one, Annie Sundberg, Ricky Stern coming right up with their film. It's called In My Father's House, which opens in theaters nationwide on October 9th. It is as described as an award-winning documentary about hip-hop artist Shay Rhymefest Smith, who is the co-writer of the recent Oscar-winning song Glory, which was used in the movie Selma just recently, and the 2005 Grammy winner for the song Jesus Walks, which he recorded with Kanye West. And this is his deeply personal story about him and his relationship with his father, who he was estranged from for decades, and this guy, Shay Rhymefest Smith, and living in Chicago, trying to start a new family. He buys this house in Chicago on the South Side, which was previously owned by his father's family. So his father, Shay's father, grew up in this house, and it sort of spurs Shay to seek out his estranged father, who he knows is homeless and he knows is an alcoholic. And this documentary follows the period of time from then through that next chapter of these two men who are reconnected. And it's a very powerful story about Shay and his father, Brian Smith. And so I recommend it. I think it premiered at Tribeca, and it's been making it the rounds at festivals. And now, as I mentioned, it's opening up Friday, October 9th, around the country. Do check it out. It's called In My Father's House. And without further ado, here's my conversation with Annie Sundberg and Ricky Stern.
I haven't spoken to my father since I was 12 years old.
I wonder if he knows that I'm Rhymefest.
He's from Chicago. He won a Grammy for co-writing Jesus Walks, the Kanye West song.
When I found my father, he was homeless on the west side of Chicago.
This is for me, man. Son, this is Rhymefest.
Been going through some hard times. Homeless, jobless too.
You gotta wanna be better. You gotta wanna change. I want a father that I'm proud to walk down the street with. You gotta be better.
I don't want this to become, I become the father and he becomes the son.
I guess what I'm looking for is seeing what I could be. I mean, at the end of the day, I'm a piece of him. I'm a piece of him.
She was traumatized slightly.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
So the dirty nether regions of the lives of documentary filmmakers.
Yeah. All right.
Go ahead.
Ready.
Oh, we're ready. I'm all
we're
ready.
Rolling.
You were
okay.
All. Yeah, that's the sneaky part.
We're rolling.
Is that Fashion Fund? I was watching you guys
editing.
Yeah,
we're doing a 10-part series mm-hmm. for Amazon on the CFDA Vogue Fashion Fund.
Right. How's that? You're working with Anna Wintour on that?
Yeah, so Anna Wintour is, mm-hmm. yes, and nine other, she's one of the judges.
Oh, okay.
And nine other, like Diane von Furstenberg and the head of J. Crew, Jenna Lyons, uh-huh. Rag & Bone, the designers from Rag & Bone, mm-hmm. Some great judges.
I don't know. You look very put together and attractive, of course, but do you now feel all the more pressure in the morning when you're leaving?
When you're shooting? No, this is only because I like wore this and didn't change my clothes on the plane and like the whole thing because of the film festival.
I know, but is there pressure now that you're doing fashion thing? You know?
Yeah, we dress up. I only think twice about what I'm wearing when we're shooting at the Vogue offices.
Right.
Otherwise, I don't.
I mean, there is the filmmaker uniform. They come to expect that, I'm sure.
Yes, true. Right? Sneakers and jeans and t-shirts.
Well, thanks. And we're going to hopefully be joined in a few minutes by your filmmaker partner, Annie. And so as we speak, I'm glad actually we did it. I didn't think of this when we spoke on the phone earlier that my other guest's film is opening at the Film Forum. I have like two segments on this next episode. I'm going to like churn this out like overnight.
Okay.
Because your film, of course, opens this Friday, the 9th of October. Nationwide. And then this other film opens Wednesday, tomorrow. Guy Madden's film. So I definitely have to try to get it out. I can always figure that out if I have to, but this made it easier meeting today. So thanks. Well, let's get started. You know, I had a couple questions about the both of you, but we can wait on that and jump right into talking about In My Father's House, which must almost feel like you made it like a long time back already, because you've been running around the festivals with it for quite a while now.
Yeah, we premiered at Tribeca this year. Mm-hmm. So we have spent the 4 months or so with the film, traveling around with it. But it usually feels this way with a film. You have your premiere festival, and then you do a bunch of other festivals, and then you gear up, hopefully, for a theatrical. So it feels fairly on proper time schedule.
Yeah. 4 months. I was thinking maybe it went longer, but I do remember you premiered at Tribeca, which wasn't really that long ago, actually. So it's still sort of like a fresh, exciting process you find yourself in. And now the subject of the film, Che Rheinfest-Smith, is he running around with you guys at certain festivals? Is he coming to New York?
He is. In fact, he's coming to New York tonight, and he is staying in my apartment. And then we are going to the Jacob Burns Center tomorrow night. And then we are going to Boston to go to Globe Docs. And then the film opens in New York on October 9th.
Globe Docs, is that the Boston Globe?
It's the Boston Globe documentary programming, yep.
Oh, very good. Okay. So it is a whirlwind. So I think I did a little reading about how you came across the subject, this guy Che, who was already, certainly in the hip-hop community, a known quantity. I mean, this guy has had some success, and he's now on another sort of spike with recent song being in Selma. And now he wrote a song for the documentary, right?
He did. He wrote a song for the documentary, yep. He's working on a new album.
Mm-hmm.
And he co-wrote the song Glory from the film Selma, which won the Academy Award last year. He co-wrote it with Common, the rap, and with John Legend.
Right. That was a highlight of the Oscars, I think. They played it out the show with that song, if I remember.
Yes.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. So did you get mixed up in all that? I mean, were you?
No.
The whole thing really was shot in Chicago, right? In the South Side of Chicago.
Yeah, we shot the film over about 14 months in the South Side of Chicago, in the Chatham area, in the West Side of Chicago as well. Uh-huh. And really finished the film before Che had this recent spike in his career. And I think he attributes his recent success. He's also the new face of the Courageous Class, a Kenneth Cole campaign. Mm-hmm. So there's billboards of him, and there's taxi ads and supporting his work, what Che does in the community in Chicago for Donda's House, working with young people in hip-hop, using hip-hop as a way to express themselves and give them, mm-hmm. Life opportunities. Just
working through in a creative way.
Yeah, working through their issues in creative outlets, arts education. But, a lot of this really came together after he met his dad. So in the process of filming, I think it was a more angst time for him, and he was really kind of at a low during some of the period of filming, and opened up some wounds, having had his father leave him as a young child and sort of disappear from his life. And then once he tracked his father down and finding out that he was homeless and an alcoholic, putting all those pieces together for him, ultimately he feels he really has become much more of a complete person.
Oh, I imagine.
And partly because partly it is that his father, who he finally really spent time with and got to know, is incredibly funny, and you see it in the film, really smart. They share a love of chess, and he's incredibly resilient. And I think Che saw a lot of himself in his father, and he never knew where his humor came from. He never, you know, knew where, you know, sort of his passion for certain things came from. And he really can look at his dad and know, you know, put that piece of the puzzle together.
It's interesting that the documentary almost sort of starts where Che has resolved to try to find his dad, who turns out to be who he hasn't seen in 25 years, and it turns out he's just blocks away at a shelter. But it seems as though it's funny that he's already kind of decided on trying to reconnect, that he's already a let go, and he's says that he is already in a place of forgiveness. So the documentary really doesn't go that route. And so many documentaries, like, of these types of stories we hear of children reconnecting with parents or being abandoned, that there is the forgiveness thing is a pretty big hurdle. Whereas here it seems like it's not, like, that this is more about kind of really trying to give this guy one more shot of being having a role in his son's life.
Yeah, I definitely think in the beginning, Che jumped in feet first, and it was like a honeymoon period of I forgive him, this is great, I have my dad is doing it, he's in a rehab program. It was when his dad couldn't live up to everything and all the expectations and couldn't make him proud in the way in which he wanted him to make him proud, that he pulled, that then Che did pull back and got angry and the hurt came out.
Was this early on or was this the late chapter? Because I don't want to give away a lot, but there's
the later chat. I mean, later in the film, you see that it wasn't all like as easy as he had expected in the beginning.
Sure. And he learns what true forgiveness, or maybe the ultimate forgiveness, is, which is allowing people to still be flawed and accept them for their limitations, which that's a hard lesson.
Absolutely.
For anybody, you know. So, and we should mention, the elder Smith.
Brian.
Brian, he, the father, his, Chase's father, is, you know, he's an alcoholic. But even though it's obviously he's homeless and living in and out of shelters, but in some ways he manages. He's a, I don't know if the term functional alcoholic applies to him quite, but within this
He calls himself a functional. I'm a functional alcoholic.
Well, on some level he is.
It's not in the cut right now. It was in the cut at one point. I mean, he says, I'm a functional alcoholic. And quite honestly, having spent a lot of time with Brian, he is. I mean, he doesn't drink all the time. He doesn't have to drink. He says, as he likes to say, I like my cocktail. Mm-hmm. But he also has anxiety and I think now, you know, suffers from some depression. And he really self-medicates with alcohol. And it was familiar for him. So you know, having essentially going cold turkey from something, you know, you have to replace that action, that activity, that behavior with something else. And so, you know, It takes a while, but it was surprising to all of us that he could just go cold turkey and not, you know, have real physical withdrawals. And it seems like, you know, now, yes. So to answer your question, I do think he was, as he would say, he was a functional alcoholic.
Well, it seemed like, you know, no small part, he was carrying around a huge burden. And the reconnection probably alleviated a little of his anxiety. But, you know, after decades, of course, like he said himself, he needs it to get to sleep. You know, there's an anxiety of not knowing you're not even going to have a drink and trying to go to bed without that when you've been doing it for decades. So, you know, it's like you just said, it's pretty amazing that he was able to even eventually stop. He was very motivated to please his son. I think that was, when you say?
Yes, I think meeting Che and then meeting his grandson Solomon and spending time with them and Donnie and Che's wife Donnie, and even reconnecting with his ex-girlfriend Che's mother Lorna, he found a lot to motivate him.
Yeah,
but honestly, you know, Brian did want to get off the street. Some of it was just motivation for himself to make a change.
Right. Okay. I imagine. Those Chicago winters, for one thing. Mm-hmm. But he was in a shelter. Well, I wasn't clear on if he was in the shelters the majority of time.
It was a nighttime shelter that you had to show up by 5 to get a bed. And they kicked you out at 5 in the morning.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not pretty.
No.
You know.
Yeah.
We're being joined by Annie Sundberg, the other, half of the Breakthrough Films. We've been kind of going through the relationship. So let's talk about, maybe Annie, you can jump in about how you comfortably embed yourself in this type of super intimate situation. And also, you have a lot on the line. Did you have your hopes hinged on the story turning out in a particular way?
I don't think that we ever enter into a Verite film hoping things go one. Well, we might have secret hopes for what we want.
Yeah.
I think we all wanted Donnie to actually get pregnant and have a child, and we wanted.
There's that. That's a subplot, if you want to call it that.
But I do think you enter into a film because you're curious to see what that journey is going to take you, and I think that's the one thing when you make documentary, and Verite in particular, where you sort of have to give yourself up. You can shape things only to a certain degree.
Some more than others.
Yeah, you can organize things by theme for yourself. You can choose to follow certain parts of someone's life and not others. I do think that the tricky part of embedding, it's always hard when you're starting to get to know people. I think one of the harder scenes to shoot was one of the scenes that we shot, at least for me. I think Ricky had many of them, but was when Shay decides to share the news with Donnie about the results of the paternity test letter. And that was a scene where we hadn't spent a lot of time with Donnie and Shay together before. And it was one of those moments where we started backing out of the room as things were getting more and more intimate with them. Mm-hmm. We had to step back from that to allow what was happening to unfold between the two of them. And our cameraman found a great angle through a mirror that allowed him to shoot the aftermath of that scene and still give Donnie a sense of privacy, which was really, I think, valuable in finding the sort of the emotional arc to that scene, because she was able to feel that she had a moment that was truly emotionally honest without us being right over her shoulder. But that's always a struggle.
Oh, yeah. That's got to be an ongoing tension, doing what you guys do.
Yeah. I would say this film in particular was hard because as a Verite film, it was so intimate. I spent a lot of time on the phone with Che. Really, it's almost like therapy. You learn so much about the person's history and their desires and everything. And so it feels like when you see them, like you've been with them for all the time you've been apart. And that's really important. And then once Brian got his phone, we could spend time with Brian too. Mm. And really spend a lot of time with Brian alone, away from Che, which was really important. But it's hard because people jump into allowing you in their lives and they say, yes, I want you to document this. And then, 4 months later, 6 months later, 8 months later, when it hits the fan, they're like, really? You really need to come and do this again? And it's a struggle, and it always is. And every film Annie and I have ever done has been lengthy time with people. And
no matter how much you also maybe try to warn them from the start that this is sort of the phenomenon that occurs, it doesn't really
You're not going to want us there at 6 in the morning, but we're going to be there at 6 in the morning. And you're not going to want us at the end of a long day at 9 o'clock at night when you just want to, get a pizza and go, and we're going to be there with you. And the other thing is that I think what people don't always know about a Verite documentary is that the whole time we're thinking about the edit and we're thinking about the shoots and we're thinking about the planning and we're thinking about the layering of the narrative and we're thinking about everyone's motivation and how to capture that, because it may change. And you're constantly thinking of it as characters in a story, as if you're writing the story, and you're trying to figure out really what are they going for or what do they think they're going for, and how can we help visualize this. And
And it's a liquid thing, because like you say, you're trying to assemble it in your mind as you're going, but life has other plans, as this phrase goes, right? It's kind of remarkable just how many, there are so many textures here. For one thing, at the beginning, Che and his wife buy a house in Chicago, and he's investing in, he's putting his money where his mouth is in a sense, and he's actually buying a house on the South Side. I don't know if that was just an economic choice or not, but it's not just any house. This is the house his dad grew up in. And so that structurally must have been a like kind of a gift in the sense of now he's, of course, doing two things. He's seeking out his father, and he's also going back. He realizes he has to rectify certain things going on in his own life and the way he's approaching. You mentioned the paternity test and all that.
Well, I think that's what attracted us to the story, is just that we knew Che had already been documenting a lot of his life as a rapper, but had literally been filming when he drove by his dad's old house. And we have footage of him actually moving in. It's just not even really in the film. Moves into the house. And once he's in the house, he starts to wonder about his father and films very early those scenes. And then we saw that knowing that this is like, you couldn't script this because, you know, it would be too perfect. And yet it was really the journey he was going on. So we were attracted to the story because of that, because the setup was so ripe for things to happen, story to unfold.
Who buys their father's home who's abandoned? That's very, very dramatic and almost kind of Shakespearean terms. You know? Yeah. And how did everybody respond to the film? Where did they were they at Tribeca? Was that there? Or did they got it? You know, they must have gotten an advanced screening. I'm going to guess.
Tribeca was the premiere.
Right.
And that was actually a really great experience, I think, to see, well, first of all, to have Brian and Che and Donnie part of all of those screenings was
Donnie's
really meaningful. And I think there is something that always happens, you know, you say yes to a film journey and then you see audiences respond to your story. And I think that it makes, I hope that, you know, I know it's made Brian feel pretty good, and I'm hoping that Che is still enjoying the process. Last night was really unique. We had a chance to do a sneak screening in Chicago.
In Chicago, which is right.
And that was particularly resonant. Common came. Common and Che have a long history, having grown up together and then working together, obviously, on the song Glory from Selma. And he came out to support the film last night and to support Che. And more importantly, there was such a community that came to this film. People who'd known Che through different parts of his life, the political work he'd done in Chicago, his music work, the Donda's House work that they do with youth. And then there was the sort of Heartland Alliance, Safe Haven, the people who provide, you know, social services for people like Brian. It was a pretty emotional night, and it was that. I mean, I don't know how many people were at the screening. Was it close to 400?
I think it was around 500 people, if not more. Yeah, it was at the Music Box Theater, which is a great old theater in Chicago, and it was just great. All of Che's family was there, and many people from the community.
And it was such a funny mix, because I think there are different layers that play out in this film, and people are seeing different things. One thing that always comes up is, you know, afterwards, people say, I have a broken relationship with my mother, or my father's an addict, or I was abused. You know, someone will have some fracture in their family that then they say, you know, I'm now inspired to try to figure out how to make that somehow whole for myself.
Right.
And well, that seems to be the very personal takeaway that people have with this film. But I also hope that they're seeing that it's not always just your biological family. It's the other elements that, you know, you're surrounding yourself with in your world.
Yeah, I mean, the ending, kind of without giving it away in specific terms, is the big takeaway, because, you know, we learn about what it truly takes to move on. You can forgive on one level, but then you have to also, like in the of the past, but you have to also kind of forgive of the present, which is something most people maybe don't anticipate. But it's a very moving few scenes in there. The ending's very moving, I'll have to admit. And I wanted to ask you, the statistics you flashed on the screen at the beginning, and this is not an advocacy film, it's not about that, it's a very much a very tape personal film, but it kind of staggering, those statistics.
I think that was our point, was that because this is such a personal film and such an intimate film, it was important for us to say that this is more the norm than not for so many. And not knowing a parent, growing up in a single house family household, that it is something that a lot of people can connect to. I mean, it may not be that it was the South Side of Chicago, but you might have grown up, you know, in Northern California and had a similar experience. And to Annie's point, people bring to it their own history, their own story, and the film seems to have an impact on people in a very personal way, but really based on their own history. So some people are just attached to the addiction story because they've had a history of it or they know people. Some are attached to the homelessness aspect of it, someone came up to me last night and said, my brother has been homeless for 30 years. And some are attached to the parenting part of it, where they don't know their mother. They don't know their father. They grew up with a grandparent and had issues raising their own children. So we felt it was important to make known that this is not just a small story. This is a big national story.
I mean, this is a little bit off piece, but I was listening to a podcast with Louis C.K. the other day. It was just one of the, it was like an old fresh air. And he even talked about how he grew up basically, in essence, single parent, family. And I think everybody who does that, at least people who have the strength to do it, they seek parents elsewhere. Like, he makes the notion that if one parent can only give you 20% because they're compromised in some way, and the other parent is either not there or gives you 30%, you're going to make up that other by looking somewhere for someone. And I think what the other element that we're hoping people take from this film is a group like Donda's House can really fill in those cases. Mm-hmm. A lot of these kids really don't have opportunities to connect with direct biological family or foster family. And the idea is, here's this other alternate family that hopefully will be just as healthy,
sure.
And good for them.
Winding down. I know in a couple of past documentaries, like, you've each kind of taken the helm, so to speak, and the other one is more there in a secondary role. Is that, I don't know if that's kind of clumsy way of maybe describing it. Is it fair to say this was a real more of a like your partnership on this film in terms of directing?
I think the only film maybe you're talking about is Joan Rivers, but yeah, that was just a unique situation, but usually we go into it hand in hand, and like, there may be occasions where one person is going to shoot more up front with another, but it's pretty important that we both develop a relationship with the story and the people in it. But it's a lot of time, as you know, so it does help sometimes to be able to say, to have another person who knows the characters and the people and have relationships. We also, I have to give credit to Charles Miller, who shot this with us. He also, was there a lot, and sometimes he ended, up doing the overnight at Brian's house if one of us had to go. So it was really having a small team, one DP, just Annie or me, and a sound person, and that's just the way we work, and I think that creates that kind of intimacy as well.
Last question, maybe you could take it. I would have asked at the beginning, just because I don't know how you guys originally met, the two of you.
Well, we both went to the same college, but we didn't know each other in school, and we met working on an independent film when we were out of school. So there you go.
That's a good answer. Which film?
It was an independent feature shooting in Vermont called Where the Rivers Flow North, and it was a Sundance-funded film, and it was totally independent. This guy's still doing it. Jay Craven teaches kids in the Northeast Kingdom of Vermont at Marlborough College, and he makes regional films.
And it was a narrative?
It was a narrative, yeah.
Well, the film is called, the new documentary is called In My Father's House, and it's distributed by...
It's ARC Entertainment in AMC Theaters. It actually came out, the distribution came out as in some ways a gift, the Bentonville Film Festival, in hopes of promoting cultural diversity in screen representation, said, we will give the winning films distribution. And the winning films either had women, just because of the nature of the festival, had minority stories at their focus or women directors. And they thought megaplexes, interestingly enough, should have these films. The film will be released in 20 AMC theaters nationwide.
I'm hearing this more and more. Megaplexes are supporting independent films of distribution and exhibition of. Congratulations, and everybody should go out and check out this.
We'll be in New York at AMC on Monday, October 12th, with Che.
At the AMC Empire 25.
AMC Empire 25, 42nd Street. At 6 p.m. is the screening, and then we'll be doing a Q&A afterwards.
So that's the one you want to hit up, obviously, if you can. But go this weekend and see it. And, thank you both.
Thank you.
Glad we finally got around to this. Alrighty, let's go now to The Forbidden Room. Again, it's a film directed by Guy Maddin and co-directed by Evan Johnson. And it's had this pretty amazing festival run. And what is it about? Well, the log line that its distributor, Kino Lorber, published, says here, a submarine crew, a feared pack of forest bandits, a famous surgeon, and a battalion of child soldiers all get more than they bargained for as they wend their way toward progressive ideas on love and life. Life and love. It's an incredibly cinematic film. I mean, of course, you could say that all cinema is cinematic. Yes and no. But The Forbidden Room is an explosion of, it's an ode to the lost cinema. And the cast, I should also mention, is spectacular. You have the French, this enormously popular French actor, Matthew Amalric. You have the legendary actor, Udo Kier. The legendary Charlotte Rampling. The legendary Geraldine Chaplin. And on and on. But, I mean, what a cast. So we're going to talk about that as well. And the film is opening in New York at the Film Forum Wednesday, the 7th of October, and other areas, and I assume other spots as well. Anyhow, without further ado, here is my conversation with Guy Madden.
Hello, I'm Marv. Today we're going to discuss baths.
Heaven suffers in once. We need food. We need oxygen.
Flapjacks.
There are air pockets in the batter. Our oxygen will last almost twice as long
with these babies.
This is fresh water.
He got in. Maybe we can get out.
They have Margot, and who knows what they're doing to her.
We all have our axes and our brawn. Strong men.
We just have to get together and attack.
Nobody looks good at Skype. I don't know what it is.
I will look at myself in private, but this is another matter. not while I'm talking. I listening to myself and looking at myself at the same time, forget it.
It's true. It's very distracting.
Just watching the hot air coming out of that hole in my face. Too much. Okay, let you concentrate on...
I'm good.
Okay, gotcha. So this won't be edited much. I should try to keep things flowing.
Well, let me officially say hello, Guy, and for the French listeners, Guy. And thank you for... Mm-hmm. And thanks for, making this work.
It's great to be on your podcast, Adam. Thank you.
I mean... You're in the kind of vortex at the moment, right?
Yeah, I didn't think of it as a vortex. I thought of it as a graveyard spiral.
Come on.
Vortex sounds more exciting. It sounds like I'm actually fighting for my life or something.
Well, not only do you have your 11th feature coming out.
That's right.
In this fall, I mean, you're in the thrust of a vortex. It is getting a rather dramatic sound. But you're about to head to TIFF and Woodstock.
Yep.
And if unless I'm mistaken, this fall, didn't you also start a residency at Harvard?
It's a one-year job. I'm a guest lecturer till the end of May at Harvard. Yeah, it's amazing. It's the kind of thing I'm already having chiseled into my gravestone.
And, no doubt.
Pasted into my obituary. I'm very honored. It's I've decided to be the most collegial person in the history of colleges.
How is that done?
By not turning down a single invitation to a talk or by going to everything at the Harvard Film Archives and even the Brattle Theater down the street by going out for dinner. There's some really cool filmmakers I adore on faculty here. Philippe Grandrieu, the French filmmaker, the most ferocious photographer in the world. Athena Sangari, the amazing Greek filmmaker. Ben Rivers is here, one of the great experimental filmmakers of all time, and Lucien Castaigne Taylor, who made Leviathan, that fantastic fishing boat movie.
Of course.
So I don't know. We just get to hang out together. I'm the stupidest man at Harvard, but I'm going to learn something while I'm here.
And are your folks still alive by any chance?
My folks.
Your
it's funny you mention that. My dad died in 1977, but he's kind of been dying on the installment plan. He keeps reappearing in dreams to tell me what I'm doing wrong in my life. I finally passed him in late May in number of years and days that he lived, so I'm finally older than he ever got to be, and that's humiliated him a bit. And
he's letting me that in the recent dream.
What's that, sir?
He's let you know that in a recent dream, has he?
Yeah. He's just gotten less. He's just gotten off his high horse. And my mother is also dying on the installment plan. She's still physically there and can, at age 99, can kick like a Radio City Music Hall rockette. But her memory is fading with oblivion right now. So my parents are both still very present, and both of them are suitably proud and confused and forgetful of the fact I'm at Harvard.
Well, I hope your dad lets you off the hook. I mean, he should now finally go like into wherever the post-dream visits go, where he would go, because, you know, this seems to be like every parent's ultimate expectation of a kid, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, if you're teaching at Harvard,
much of their kids, and they didn't really get much. But I shouldn't say that about my siblings. They're wonderful, but I was determined to under-deliver in my first few decades on Earth, and I did. But now I can take my dad out to the woodshed. You know, it's it feels good.
Wow. But listen, this is interesting segue. I mean, you invite by talking about your parents in this way, and I wasn't even setting it up for that purpose, but you talk to them, and the way you even phrase how your dad visits you when your mom is still around and all, it makes me think of some of your filmmaking and that some of the nostalgia and personal side to it that comes through throughout some of your films. Not so much the case with the new film, though, but...
There's a little episode in the new film where I found that this... Mikio Naruza lost film, Strength of a Mustache, dealt with father-son relations. And so I felt like I was in territory I knew, and shooting that, I don't know, that might be the only place where I understood the emotions that the original directors were going for. No, it's not so much nostalgia. It was, it's the kind of spiritism, the kind of belief in mysticism that I have only when I'm holding a camera. I'm pretty literal-minded and godless whenever I'm not making a movie, but when I'm, you know, trying to dream up a script or actually shoot something, I get pretty possessed by all sorts of ecto-loopy spirits. Yeah.
Is this something you talk about in your classes? Or
I don't think my classes are quite ready for it. I teach intro filmmaking and then intermediate filmmaking here at Harvard. But I teach film studies in the second term, and I will be teaching this course called Enchanted Cinema. And it's where we watch and study films about childhood and or made in the spirit of an enchanted state of creation that we associate with childhood art.
Might there be some classic French films in there?
For sure. Jeu Interdit, Forbidden Games, Zero for Conduct by Jean Vigo, who is kind of my god.
L'Atalante, right? That guy.
L'Atalante he made, yeah. And Los Alvedados, the fantastic kids or juvenile delinquent movie made by Buñuel. There's many more. Night of the Hunter, stuff like that.
Oh, right, of course. What was your first experience with this notion of being a filmmaker? When you were a child, were you even close to making a perception about yourself like that?
Well, I think almost every kid watching a movie imagines him or herself making a movie, you know, making, you know, as the filmmaker as well as the viewer at some point. And I was an obsessive horror movie watcher as a kid. I hung out at the Grindhouse locally. I was about 14. But then I just fell out of love with the whole thing in favor of a new passion, baseball, and baseball on the radio and baseball stats. But I rotated my hemispheres around age 24 and started watching movies and reading books and even going to plays, for crying out loud, and hanging out on film sets. Believe it or not, there were film sets in Winnipeg, other filmmakers. I volunteered, flirted with people.
Something you might not have been able to do even in Toronto, right? Like, it would just not, or Montreal, maybe you could.
Yeah, I met many Toronto-based filmmakers a few years later, but I don't know, my Winnipeginess seemed to exclude me from all their Toronto filmmaker games, and And I had a red nose on top of it. I felt kind of like an outcast. I now am good friends with many of those very same people. It was just a city it is a city. It's notorious for this, for being chilly to newcomers. And I'm oversensitive. Now, only now that I'm older than my dead dad, am I able to confront situations like that, like an adult. But I used to just shrink into a corner and feel sorry for myself.
Did you ever go to a therapist?
No. Why me? Why would I do that?
I don't know. It's the way you kind of talk about yourself. It seems
like I can handle myself. Thank you.
Oh, so people that go to therapists are I don't know.
Yeah, they're weaklings. No. I approve wholeheartedly, especially if the therapist is good. I know many people who've gotten a good deal of help from them, and others who've, you know, been hit on by their therapist and things like that. So it's obviously, you know, luck of the draw.
In my case, I'd love, if I'm hit on by my therapist, I would look at that as being helpful. But that's, you know, it would depend. No, I shouldn't make a joke. Obviously, that could be very...
That's okay.
Very difficult for people.
You know what? I have gone to a therapist, kind of, because...
I knew it was going to be...
I'm heaping so much autobiography into my movies that just making these things is therapy.
True, I understand that. You're excavating. I understand it. Are you looking back at the film afterward with some distance and then kind of arriving at some of that excavation? Or does more of it take place during the process? I mean,
there's two ways. I usually make a movie about something from my life that I'm obsessed with. But just the act of turning something really beloved into a film script requires work. And it divides your life into work units. Things that need to be scripted, storyboarded, shot listed, cast, costumed, lit, edited, sound mixed, talked about. And by the time you're finished the whole process, and it's, you know, it's a couple of years have gone by, you're really sick of yourself. And not only that, so it's really just aversion therapy. There's another wave to the therapeutic process. But talking about the films after, you run out of the truth pretty quickly, and then you decide to start fibbing just to entertain yourself, to be mischievous, and to keep yourself awake during Q&A periods. And then you pretty soon run out of lies as well. And then after a while, after a few years, you do look back and you realize that the lies you chose to tell are actually more revealing than any amount of truth you would accidentally spill out.
And it's
just true. And that you finally figure out that you were lying in such a way that described in razor sharp focus just who you are to yourself and to anyone who's still awake at the end of the one of my movies.
I was going to say, actually, I have a little bit of experience with songwriting and all. I used to write lots of songs. And then I've since kind of stopped, to be honest. And what I found, though, going back and playing some of those old ones is, even though I thought I was writing fiction, they all kind of explain how I turned out.
Yeah, yeah.
So some of them are kind of creepily prescient, you know.
It's inevitable. You know, it's coming from you. Even if you were plagiarizing the work of someone else, it would still be a portrait of you, because what you chose to plagiarize would be a portrait of you. So, yeah. You know, there you go.
Was this cast, to go more to, a corporeal conversation for a minute, I know you've worked, like, with Udo Kier before. Did I pronounce his name correctly, too?
Yeah, Udo Kier, star of Paul Morrissey, Andy Warhol's Frankenstein.
Yeah.
And he's been in every Lars von Trier movie except one.
Right. Yes, that's right. But this is also, I don't know if you ever worked with Charlotte Rampling or Geraldine Chaplin. I don't think you've ever worked with, I can say probably confidently, you didn't work with Matthew Amalric. But was that a bit intimidating? I mean, or was it, I imagine somebody like having Charlotte Rampling walking around the set, you've got to be shaking your head
Yeah. No, Geraldine Chaplin I had worked with before. She narrates live my movie Brand Upon the Brain whenever it's performed in Spanish-speaking countries. She speaks Spanish,
right?
And she's great. And I first worked with her in a live setting in some opera house in Mexico City a few years ago. So I asked her as a favor to come to Paris to shoot The Forbidden Room, because I thought I was going to have to be casting out of my all my Facebook friends, my Paris-based Facebook friends. But I met a great, he's now a great friend, Alexander Nazari, and a casting agent there who really had an in with the Parisian acting community. He knew which ones would be up for an adventure, which ones were not likely to be. And so everyone we invited to participate did. And one of them was Charlotte Rampling. It was just a matter of going for coffee or lunch with every one of these people. I was really shocked. You know, when Charlotte told me she'd watched not one, not two, but three of my features the night before, I said she liked them. I said, wow, you're sweet. And she said, I am not sweet. And indeed she isn't. But she is warm and wonderful. But, you know, she does speak her mind. And she has those gorgeous blue husky dog eyes. And one feels maybe the ability to just lunge for your throat like a husky dog, too. But she never did. She was bringing baking to the set. And it was really sweet. But it's true. I always had kind of one foot ready to flee in case that lunge happened.
Sure. Well, maybe the experience the lunge. It's a good anecdote, you know. But I get it. Yeah, she seems like she could be intimidating.
I should have just surrendered to the idea that she would lunge, and then maybe those tiny subtle little body language things, the equivalent of lying on the ground and exposing your fleshy underparts to just let it happen.
Already. And sort of make a half lazy effort to free yourself, you know, but I mean, come on. I would love her to, you know, it would be great. But so that was a positive, though, at the end of the day, of course. What are you going to say? But it was a very positive experience, I take it.
I really loved it, and I'd love to go back to France and work. And so I hope my next picture is a French production or a French-Canada co-production. We can make that happen. There's treaties between the two countries. I think the only co-production treaty Canada doesn't have is a U.S.-Canada co-production. So there are all sorts of tricky quotas that have to be juggled and things whenever we two nations work together in front of a camera. But I had such a good time in Paris, and I liked my morning routines of getting up and walking to some, you know, cafe. And
you realize every single person who ever visits Paris says that.
I know. It's ridiculous.
Decade after decade.
I'm living the cliche. It's the cliche dream.
No, it's not. It's a cliche, but it's absolutely everybody's experience. They go and they love that, just going to a cafe and sitting there, and you feel like it doesn't really get a whole lot better. This is like one of those experiences that it doesn't, you know, it's up there at the top. We should wind down. I mean, I had a lot of other stuff to ask you about, like what this collaboration in the last few years with Evan Johnson, who is another... is he a Winnipeg-based filmmaker as well?
Yeah, he was just a student of mine when he was 18.
Oh, okay.
He's 32 now, I believe. And after he graduated, I needed favors from him. He was really just an acquaintance, not yet a friend. But I hired him as an assistant whenever I went away for weeks or months at a time to look after my apartment. And he was a natural. He's really bright. It's unbelievable. And he was a natural choice when I needed a research assistant on this lost film internet project, which eventually led to the feature film Forbidden Room. And after we spent a couple weeks in the same room together researching lost films, he had so many ideas for the project that they were faster, more modern, cleverer, really conceptually sharp. It became apparent that I better name him a co-creator and co-director before he actually just took over my job, you know. So I really love working with him. We work well together. We're really blunt and honest with each other without ever hurting each other's feelings, right? Something that is a miracle considering we're both Canadian. and Canadians are so diffident and so unwilling to express what they're really thinking. But we are 100% blunt with each other. And we may apologize to each other afterwards, but it's right. Never necessary, I don't think.
Right.
It's great. And so we're not married to each other. We're just, for the moment, serially monogamous. And we're going to take it one picture at a time. And I hope we make many movies together. His brother's amazing, too. He's my production designer, sound designer, graphic designer, Galen Johnson. And we just finished another film that's been installed at TIFF. It's called Bring Me the Head of Tim Horton, and it's a making-of documentary. We went to Jordan, where Canadian filmmaker Paul Gross was making a war film about Canadian involvement in Afghanistan, and we followed his crew and made a picture. So the three of us were co-directors on that picture.
Terrific. Wow. I was supposed to go to TIFF. I'm not able, after all, because I got this work I'm doing, but it's quite an impressive... You premiered at Sundance, and the film, The Forbidden Room, we're talking about again, they went to Berlin, and then now it's going to TIFF.
Yeah, and we've since screw-tightened it a little bit. It used to run clock in at 2 hours and 14 minutes, but it's just under 2 hours now. It sounds long, and it's the kind of film that needs to be a bit too much. It's really packed. It's really dense. And I want people to like it, and I don't want to kill people, but I want people to feel like they're just washed up, panting on a shore somewhere when it's done, you know? So it's really packed, and it needed to be too much. Too much is just right in this case, I think.
Perfect. And then you will be at Woodstock, which is one of the... I mean, I probably would have gotten through to you regardless because of Ryan... and Charlie, those guys, but I got through on Woodstock, and then New York Film Festival, right? So I'll probably see you in Woodstock for sure, and then maybe New York Film Festival, so we'll see.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to seeing Adam and Gold in a Woodstock.
Oh my God, yeah. Well, put in a good word for me, because, you know, I don't know if I impress you at all, probably not, but I'm trying to chase after him, too. I'm way behind the Canadians, but no, I've wanted you on, and I've wanted Adam on for a long time, and...
He'll give you a great interview. He's an unbelievably loquacious and hilarious speaker. Man, that guy knows his film.
I bet. And then the Film Forum in New York City. So there's lots of opportunities to see your film coming up.
Yeah, and it's coming for your British listeners. It's coming to the London Film Festival on October 9th as well. It's going to be shown in IMAX there.
Wonderful.
I'm really thrilled.
I'll have all the dates up there.
Great.
Thank you.
Okay, fantastic. Sounds like you got to get out of your room. I should get on with my class anyway, so wonderful talking to you. Take care, Adam.
All right, guys. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to that show. Wasn't that a good one? What a great episode of Film Wax Radio, the episode number 316. On 317, as I mentioned, we have the filmmaker Michael Schultz, and we also are going to be joined by the founder and the director of the Red Hook Film Festival, Daniel Derning, will be on the show. And there's more coming up, so just stay tuned. And if to keep in touch with us, as I usually mention, you can go to our website, filmwaxradio.com, which is really just a launching place to find out what you want to find out about the podcast. But there's an archive button. It'll take you to, you can listen to all the shows, but you can go to iTunes. But if you go to the website, there is a, on the front page there, is a spot where you can write us a note. If you want to send me a message, I do read them all. I get around to responding to all of them eventually, if not right away. And we're, of course, on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio, I'm also there too as my own self, Adam Shartoff. You can also check that out. We're on Twitter. If you find us on, you could just search Filmwax and it'll come up. And as you can search iTunes, the store under Filmwax, and subscribe. And I know I say this every time, but you know, the show is free and you know, you basically get a ton of your money in that case. But all I'm asking for in return is just to leave us a nice star rating when you go to iTunes and you subscribe, and also to maybe leave a comment there. It's really great. But the star rating for sure, because that is what, if I get enough of them, and I don't have a, I have a tiny, tiny, tiny number there, and I don't know why that is, but if everybody listening could take the extra moment or two, holy cow, go to iTunes, leave a star rating on the show, you know, eventually the show moves up the ranks, up that pyramid, you know, and the show appears more as a recommended podcast to people who enjoy podcasts about film and the arts, that kind of thing. So, and then lastly, of course, is you can just reach out. I mean, you can just reach out to your friends and family and anybody you know that loves it. If you go to a film school, please tell the film department about what I'm doing, or put me in touch with them.
I would love to be in touch with the film departments around the country, because I can then let generations of young filmmakers and graduating filmmakers, film students, know about what I'm doing. And I think it's a valuable resource for anybody grappling and considering a life in filmmaking. This show is right up their alley, right? Right, isn't it? Anyway, I am off this weekend to the Hamptons International Film Festival on Friday morning. I guess I'm going to hop on the jitney and head over to East Hampton. And if you're coming, look out for me. I'll be there through Sunday at least, and I'm looking forward to it. I had a great time in Woodstock this past weekend and at the New York Film Festival right here in town. And so now this is kind of ending this little phase. I think it's going to get quiet for a little while through the holidays, and then hopefully things pick back up soon. But if you're at the Hamptons, shoot me a note on Facebook or something, or just, you know, if you see me, please stop me and say hello. I'm going to be trying to see a few good films and maybe go to a couple of panels and have a good time. Alrighty. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening. My name is Adam Chartoff. The name of the podcast, again, is Film Wax Radio. This has been episode number 316. Thank you for listening. Until next time, take care.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
To the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walk through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.